This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Health and Living. I'm Lee Chui Lin. Recently, we've heard the news that local actor Tony Yusuf has been charged for drug possession in Singapore and faces 10 years of jail time, a fine of over 50,000 ringgit or both. All this because he was found to have 4.5 grams of marijuana on his person. Also in recent days, the Johns Hopkins Lancet Commission has come out calling for the decriminalisation of minor drug offences. In their report, they've stated concern that the war on drugs approach is putting public health, scientific evidence and human rights on the sidelines. Professor Adiba Kamaruzaman, one of the co-chairs of the commission, has come to speak to us today about emphasising public health care in the way we tackle drug use and her views ahead of the first UN special session on drugs since 1998. Professor Adiba, let's begin with this. A summary of the report. What did it contain?
Good morning. Yeah, well, what the report hopes to achieve is to highlight the negative consequences of the so-called war on drugs, where a more punitive approach to dealing with the problem of drug use as opposed to a public health approach. And it highlights that some of the negative consequences that we highlighted in the report includes specifically the rise in homicide in Mexico. When Mexico chose to deal with the expansion of drugs through the use of military force, it created a lot of violence and actually caused a lot of deaths. The report shows that it led to a decline in life expectancy in Mexico as a result of this. Thousands and thousands of people have been killed in the aftermath of the violence around the war on drugs in Mexico. Secondly, we highlighted the fact that the link between the criminalization approach and the HIV and hepatitis C epidemics in particular for two reasons. The resistance to a harm reduction approach to people who inject drugs, and as a result you get the spread of HIV infection from sharing of used needles and so forth. And secondly, from incarceration of people who use drugs, because when you incarcerate people in that confined area, there are still prisons in the world where drugs will get in, so they share needles in prison, and that increases the risk for both HIV and Hep C. And the other thing it's done is also led to the spread of TB in prisons. Yeah. So there are some of the examples that we highlighted. Yeah.
What was your role in putting together the statement?
So there were 22 of us that ranged from academics and clinicians like myself to people who work in the social science even political figures. And so there was a broad range of people, and then I was honoured to have been asked to co-chair this this commission together with Professor Michelle Katzenskin from who's the UN ambassador for Central Europe and East Asia, or UN Secretary General for Europe and Eastern Europe and Central Asia.
You referenced Mexico's war on drugs earlier. And so the war on drugs approach, I guess, is relatively straightforward. It's just taking a very hardline mm-hmm. Approach to drug offences. But how was it, did it start there? I mean, where did it start and how was it developed? How did it spread?
Well, the entire war on drugs, approach probably started in the 70s in the US. That was when there was an increase in particularly black Americans using drugs. And some would say that the Nixon administration, it was a way of controlling the black Americans. And so laws were introduced. To this day, you see that the most number of people being imprisoned in the US, and there is a massive increase of incarceration people who use drugs, who are, for the most part, Black Americans from that. And from there, the you know, it's in a way spread around the world, and people use the international conventions as an excuse, I suppose, to take this approach.
What are global or local statistics to assess the current policies on drugs? You know, how successful have these policies actually been?
That's a difficult thing because I think, you know, I don't think there's been very good evaluation of there are evaluations of the negative impact, but the positive impact of a sort of a criminal justice approach to drugs, you know, haven't come. There's not been, you know, such evaluation, at least locally anyway. What we have done is actually, this is something that we've not published yet, but it's actually under review, is to compare, for instance, we did compare about close to 100 patients who were put into Pusat Serenti, or as it's currently known, PUSPEN, versus those who underwent treatment in the cure and care centres with methadone. And this study, and we followed them up for a year, and this study clearly showed that those who come out of PUSPEN will relapse, or 50% of them will relapse within 3 months, whereas those who undergo methadone therapy will stay off drugs, and half of them will only relapse in a year's time. So there's massive difference.
What is the difference between drug use and drug abuse? I think that's something that kind of... Is there a line?
Yeah. So, there is a line between drug use and drug dependence. Many people use drugs. Millions and millions of people use drugs around the world. And usually it's transient. It's for pleasure and for, you know, party drugs and so forth. But once you get addicted to it, once you have a physical and psychological dependence on it, that's what, you know, in medical terms, is drug dependence.
How are they viewed or punished under Malaysian law in terms of, you know, drug abuse, drug dependence?
Unfortunately, in Malaysia, if you're found to have any
drugs at all,
you could be charged. Yeah, and therein lies the problem. You know, because you know, it could be your first time that you trying this out, and you could be charged, and you know, find yourself in prison, and that really essentially destroys your life because you have a criminal record, you're not able to work, and so forth. Yeah.
And it's also just, it could just be a question of wrong place, wrong time.
Yes, yeah.
The Commission has advised, you know, with all that said, that certain drug-related offences should be decriminalised. Which of the current offences do you view, in your view, should be decriminalised, and based on what evidence?
Right, so... what essentially it's saying is, in terms of a broad policy, is personal drug use, where it doesn't lead to violence, should be decriminalised. And in fact, what we're advocating is for people who need treatment, they should be taken for treatment and not put into prison. Essentially, what the policy recommendation is. In Malaysia, you know, you have a whole list of ACTA. You know, some ACTAs actually are treatment ACTA, and the other is for trafficking and so forth. So that needs to be really, really carefully looked at. And the other thing in Malaysia is we don't make a difference between the different drugs, you know, and we make a slight difference in terms of quantum, but, you know, heroin and cocaine and ganja are all lumped as dangerous drugs, whereas there should be kind of a gradation in terms of the harm to a person.
If we did decriminalise these offences, how would that change the way Malaysia combats drug syndicates? Is that something we need to take into account?
So this is where we need to have there needs to be a big difference between a person who uses drugs and the person who traffics drugs. So we're not, we of course, people who traffic big amounts of drugs and all that should be pursued. But for the average person who uses drugs, they shouldn't go to prison. Our effort, our resources, whether it's police or customs or whatever, should be towards people, and ADK should be towards people who are trafficking. Sad to say, a lot of these people get scot-free, and if you go to prison, there are thousands and thousands of young people and, you know, people in their early 20s to 40s who are in there because they've been using drugs. And drug use is a really complex thing. Why people use drugs is very complex. And what we are doing is incarcerating, people, often those who are in the lower rank of society, who are less educated, who do not have the means to access good legal support and so forth. So there's a lot of social injustice in terms of who ends up in prison for the same amount of offense.
Are there case studies that we can look at for countries who have decriminalized drug offences? I mean, what were the results of that change?
So the two best examples would be Portugal and the Czech Republic. And Portugal in particular, in the early 80s, were facing the same problems as Malaysia in terms of an escalation in drug use. And they went on to decriminalize personal drug use. And what they did was allocated the resources towards treatment, towards harm reduction. So it's not just about decriminalizing, it's also about resource allocation from putting people in jail, from having police chase, the average man in the street who's using drugs, to putting that resource into catching the big fish and also putting the resource into expansion of, let's say, methadone treatment programs, training of counselors, needle exchange program, and so forth.
I'm speaking today with Professor Adiba Kamaruzzaman, and she's one of the co-chairs of the Johns Hopkins Lancet Commission that has come out recently calling for the decriminalization of minor drug offences. Up next, we look at what it would take to legalize and regulate drugs, as well as the medical consequences of this. We're talking today on Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You are listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin, and joining me in the studio today is Professor Adiba Kamaruzzaman, one of the co-chairs of the Johns Hopkins Lancet Commission that recently released a report calling for the decriminalization of minor drug offences. And we've been discussing how that would work. Now, taking it a step further, after decriminalization would be to fully legalize and regulate drugs. How is legalizing certain drugs different from decriminalizing drug offenses?
Actually, we're not even pushing for legalizing at this stage. We're certainly not. And I think that's when people will get up in arms when you say you're going to legalize drugs. So we're certainly not going down that road. We want to see decriminalization as a first step. Although you do know that some states in the US have legalized marijuana and so forth. And they're monitoring this closely, and I think the world is looking at it closely. But let me make this clear. We're not pushing for legalizing at this stage. It's more of decriminalizing. They're two very different things.
In the report, there is a statement that policing practices are worsening public health outcomes. Why is that?
So a good example of this would be, for instance, when police do raids of people who inject drugs. And what that does is that, and studies have shown this, that drug users will rush their injection, will share their needles, and will lead to unsafe practices of injection. It also prevents people who use drugs from coming forward, from accessing, whether it's methadone or HIV treatment or so forth, for fear of being arrested. So I think they're two concrete examples of that.
Could you elaborate on harm reduction strategies?
So what harm reduction refers to is the needle syringe. Essentially, there are a whole package of it, but the two main interventions are the needle syringe program so that people who use drugs only use clean needles, so to prevent the spread of HIV and hepatitis C. And the other is the opiate substitution therapy, or more commonly known as methadone maintenance treatment, so that that will prevent, you know, the cravings that's related to heroin use, and minimizes the injection, you know, the need to inject drugs.
In the report, it's also mentioned that current policy makes it difficult to compare potentially dangerous drugs with potentially harmful foods, tobacco and alcohol. How important is it to tailor the plan of action to the specific type of drug?
It is very important because I think in terms of the treatment process, for instance, right now we're also seeing a rise in amphetamine-type substances, ATS and party drugs and so forth. So with those drugs, there isn't a substitute like methadone. You know, studies are ongoing to look for the equivalent of methadone or buprenorphine for ATS users, and so far, unfortunately, there aren't good drugs to treat ATS addiction. So in terms of policies and tailoring programs, it's very important to look at, you know, what are the needs for people who are using you know, something like marijuana. What are the needs for heroin users? What are the needs for ATS users? And the kind of workforce development, you know, and counselors and treatment officers and so forth, social workers, you know, those things should be taught off in a good drug policy reform.
Who would need to be involved in order to work within those categorizations to come up with the tailoring of those programs? Because, you know, it sounds like it could potentially be complex.
It could potentially be very complex, yeah. And I think what Malaysia really needs is a total overhaul of our drug policy in terms of the focus, shifting it away from criminalization to more public health approach, number one. Number two, in terms of workforce development, even if I call for a shutdown of all the pusat serenti and reduction of the number of people going to prison, we need to develop the community support for these things. Part of the reason why drug users who come out of prison relapse very quickly is because they go back into the community with nothing. They don't have, you know, the family members have shunned them. They don't have a job. They can't get a job because, you know, the JPA says, you know, anyone who's used drugs can't get a job in the government sector and so forth. So they come out with nothing, and has nothing to look forward to. And so what do? You know, you go back to drugs. You go back to the people you're familiar with. So all that kind of social support and people with skills to deal with will need to be developed. Sadly, after 3 decades of trying to deal with drugs, we've not done that. All we've been good at is putting them in prison.
Right now, are there drug rehabilitation programs available for Malaysian prison inmates?
Yes, there are. In prison, they follow mostly the therapeutic community approach, which is more in keeping with the abstinence-based zero-tolerance approach rather than the harm reduction treatment sort of medicalized, evidence-based treatment approach.
Earlier, you talked about the difference between those two, specifically in the numbers of relapses that you see after 3 months, after a year. When it comes to ridding yourself of drugs, what are the measures that we're looking at? I mean, how often do you need to check back in with a group of people, with a person to see, to engage the success of a program?
Yeah. So there is no magic answer to this, because the first thing that we need to understand is addiction is a chronic and relapsing medical condition, you know. It depends on the chronicity. It depends on how long they've been using drugs. It depends on what drugs they've been using, whether it's one type or a combination of drugs. It depends on their social support. Do they have family members? And that's a crucial thing, you know, family members who could support them through all of this. So each program will need to tailor to the needs of the individual.
You spoke earlier of how our drug system right now needs a total reform. How far have we progressed in terms of kind of trying to introduce these elements of harm reduction, reforming the national drug policy?
Yeah. So when you think of it, of where we were in the early 2000s, we have come a long way. You know, in those days, jargons like harm reduction wasn't even used. And so by 2005, 2006, we were allowed to do needle exchange. Methadone maintenance treatment is now all over the country, most of that through the Ministry of Health clinics and hospitals. And so that's been normalized. But on the other hand, so we kind of in a schizophrenic situation. We do have this public health approach, but at the same time, we're still very much, let's have raids and arrest them and put them in prison, laws and policies in place. And so we need to come together and see the success that the harm reduction program has been, i.e. it's reduced the number of new infections from drug use by 50%. It has, resulted in probably more than 14,000 people, prevented more than 14,000 people from getting infected with HIV from a study that we've done, saved the government 40 million ringgit in terms of healthcare costs because they didn't get HIV, etc., etc. So that success is definitely there. But at the same time, we've got all these laws that says, you know, arrest, put them in prison for X, Y, Z. So there needs to be an understanding that, you know, this new approach, this new in inverted commas approach that we undertook in 2005, 2006 is showing good results, is successful, and therefore the next step would be to relook at all these laws that we have that prevent us from A, expanding the harm reduction programs, and B, unnecessarily putting a lot of young Malaysians, Malays in particular, in prison where they cycle in and out of prison because it doesn't work. You know, so and it's costing the government millions and millions of dollars of putting these people in prison, just the cost of imprisonment. But secondly, of losing, you know, a very, very important group of people, you know, young, Malay, otherwise healthy men who should be out there working instead of in prison. So it, to me, it just totally doesn't make sense. And we've had this program in Kajang Prison for the last 7 years, and we see them in there, and what it does is it not only many are infected with HIV, but it also fuels the TB problems in prison, and they come out and they go in and they go out and they go in. It's just futile. It's just a waste of money, time, everything.
What are the main challenges and roadblocks that stand in the way of getting rid of these laws?
Ideology, this moral, you know, sort of this misplaced, misguided moral ideology that, you know, people who use drugs are bad and need to be protected from society, need to be protected from themselves, and ignorance of the scientific evidence, and dare I say, corruption.
The last time the UN held a special session on drugs was in 1998 when it set the goal for a drug-free world by 2008. I think it's safe to say that that has come and gone and, you know, that goal has not been met. Do you believe it's possible for the world to be free of drug abuse?
No. No. Because, human beings are always looking for escape, for pleasure. And really, why do people smoke, you know, when they know the dangers? In fact, the personal dangers of cigarette smoking in many ways are more harmful than, say, the use of ganja, for instance. And yet we don't put those people in prison to save themselves, to save them from themselves, from smoking, or to save their families from the secondary effect of smoking. So you also need to look at that, the comparison from smoking and other drugs that we've deemed dangerous. Yeah. So to rid the world of drug abuse is not impossible. It's impossible. And to get a drug-free world is also not realistic, because for as long as there's money involved, it's a billion-trillion-dollar business. And the more you make it underground, the more, you know, you push the prohibitionist agenda, the more money people can make from this. And so, you're not going to rid of it.
What are your expectations then for the upcoming UN General Assembly special session on drugs?
The countries within the UN will come to an understanding that it's unrealistic to have a total drug-free world, and that, you know, that harm reduction is needed for those who are already, dependent on drugs. But negotiations are not going the way we'd like to see it, because there are some countries that are very, very against harm reduction and a public health approach. And the UN works by consensus.
To finish off, I mean, you mentioned consensus, and that's a good spot to end, because I think one of the things that we can see, I mean, in the states, from the legalization of drugs, from the decriminalization of drugs in certain states, is that it's bound to rile up public opinion. That always happens. Mm-hmm. You will always have people who are, you know, firm in their belief that drugs are bad.
Sure.
People who use drugs are bad, and they should go to jail. And so with public opinion being a roadblock in that sense, you know, what would you like to say as a final message to kind of address that notion? Because, I mean, our whole interview has been addressing that.
Yeah.
But if you had to sum it up.
Yeah. Well, when we introduced the harm reduction program, we copped a lot of flack for those very reasons. But, that we're encouraging drug use, these people are bad and so forth. But the proof is in the pudding. And I think, and there are many, many examples of family members re-accepting people who use drugs because, you know, they've sort of reformed and so forth. So, yes, winning public opinion is not easy, but I think it will come through education and it will come through dialogues to get people to understand and see, you know, in the past when we tried to introduce a harm reduction program, so it's a Western idea. But now, you know, it is a decade later, it's no longer a Western idea. It's no longer an experiment. It is happening in the country and it's showing good results. So people need to look around them and see the good points that have come out of it. Yeah.
Thank you very much for coming in.
You're welcome.
I've been speaking with Professor Adiba Kamrul-Zaman, Dean of the Faculty of Medicine at UM, as well as co-chair of the Johns Hopkins Lancet Commission that recently came out calling for the decriminalization of minor drug offences, which is what we've been discussing today on Health and Living. You've been listening to The Bigger Picture on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9. The Business Station.